Hello, I'm Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, and this podcast is the third episode in the Making the Money Work series, sponsored by FSCS. On these shows, I join host Andy Peters and a fascinating range of guests with unconventional lives and finances to find out how they make their money work. The five episodes will be arriving in your usual This Is Money podcast feed over the coming weeks. We hope you enjoy listening to them and learning about some lives less ordinary. This week, we speak to adventurer and micro-adventurer Alistair Humphreys.
This podcast is brought to you in association with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products are FSCS protected. Visit fscs.org.uk/thisismoney to find out more. Hello and welcome back to Making the Money Work. I'm Andy Peters, and in today's podcast, we'll be meeting an adventurer who's so adventurous, he's quite literally created his own subgenre. Now, if you're not up to speed with what this series is about, we've been exploring the lives and financial worlds of inspiring people who've opted out of the 9-to-5 to create their very own career paths, regardless of the financial risks. Some would say they're bonkers or genius. We'll be hearing from athletes, adventurers, podcasters and performers about the financial highs, lows, tips and techniques that come along with living your dreams. Our aim is to leave you feeling inspired and empowered in the knowledge that regardless of what you dream of doing, the FSCS is here to protect you. Simon, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Andy.
How are you? I'm very well, thank you very much for asking. You're an expert in your field, I know.
In theory, yes.
Yeah, and you know all things to know about the FSCS, hopefully.
I know pretty much a few things about the FSCS.
All right, yeah. You're here to help me and give me a few tips and pointers and absolutely everybody listening. But more importantly, you're here to help today's guest, who, aside from being an adventurer, is also a prolific author, blogger, filmmaker and motivational speaker. He's spent over 4 years cycling around the world, covering 46,000 miles across 60 countries and 5 different continents. Am I right so far, Alistair?
You are so far correct.
I will keep going then. More recently, he's walked across southern India, rode across the Atlantic Ocean, run 6 marathons through the Sahara Desert, completed a crossing of Iceland, busked through Spain and participated in an Arctic expedition close to the magnetic North Pole. Still right so far?
Still good.
Okay, I'll keep going. He's trekked 1,000 miles across the Empty Quarter Desert and 120 miles around the M25. He's a pioneer of the micro-adventure and was named as one of National Geographic's Adventures of the Year in 2012. You've heard his voice already. Alistair Humphreys, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
I'm exhausted just reading the things you've done. How does one get to the point where you think, I'm going to insert what you've done here?
So in the first instance, it came about because I really enjoyed reading books of adventure and expeditions and exploration. I loved those books. And I was starting to get interested in physical stuff like running marathons and hill marathons and going camping. And I'd started to appreciate that a bicycle is a great way to see places. And I still think it's the best way to see a place. And so I started wanting to combine all those things. The love of books, the physical challenge, going by bike, and also the idea that if I don't go now while I'm young, life's only going to get more tangled and complicated. Therefore, it sounds scary and a bit daft, but I should just do it now because I'll probably regret it later.
All a quest for you being an adrenaline junkie in a certain way, do you think, all the things you've achieved?
No, not at all. I think it's not really an adrenaline thing at all. It's more of a curiosity about places I haven't been and things I haven't done and curiosity about how I might cope with different things. It's much more exercising curiosity and teaching myself about the world and about myself than it is about reckless adrenaline.
So one of the things you've done, which isn't an adrenaline thrill, is busked your way around Spain. How did that come about?
That was one of the most adrenaline things I've done. So I've been doing big adventures for many years now. And so I'd got to the point where I was pretty good at riding my bike and sleeping in a tent. And what I started to notice was that although I was doing these things in wonderful places, I kind of knew what it was like. I knew how the trips would probably unfold. I knew I'd probably be fine. And in my own way, I'd actually was in a rut. I was in my comfort zone very much. But the important thing of adventure for me is about doing things that are new and frightening and uncertain. The big prospects of failure and not having a clue what's going to happen. that's what interests me about living adventurously. And I realized that I couldn't get that just by going on another camping trip. And so what I needed to do was find something that really scared me, find something that I'd probably fail and that I had no idea how it would unfold. And in my world, that involved learning the violin and standing up in plazas in Spain to play the violin, and that being my only way of getting money. So I had no wallet, no credit card, no cash, only my very bad violin skills.
On YouTube, there is a clip of you sort of telling the story of your busking around Spain, which I found absolutely fascinating, thrilling as well. And just seeing the excitement in your face when you get that first euro that somebody gives you, because I thought the man's going to literally use his walking stick to knock your stand down.
Yes.
That's genuinely, I thought he was going to get out of my country, just take your violin elsewhere. Do you still get pangs? You know, would you wake up tomorrow morning and think, actually, I do need to do something? I've been in London or wherever, in Kent for too long. I need to get up and do something now.
Yeah, very much. I think I'm the curse of the adventuring life is that when you're away, you really appreciate what you've left behind.
Yeah.
And when you're at home, you just want to be away. So yeah, I see it in many ways as a quite exciting but slightly cursed existence. Yeah, but the Spain thing was a really interesting thing, because to commit to having no money for a month, so 100% I was only going to have the money I could earn from my violin playing, which is terrible, really put a perspective on things. Now, I remember one day I found a 20-cent coin on the floor and I picked it up, thrilled, because that equates to a banana, basically, breakfast. And it just gave me a real gratitude for realising that I'm now at a point in my life and career where I earn plenty of money. I earn enough money to be fine every year.
You obviously had to be really good with your money. Did you learn many lessons sort of earning money, spending money to feed yourself and help you travel?
I think you can either earn more money and then go do a big trip, or you can spend less money and do a cheap trip. So I cycled around the world for 4 years on a total budget of £7,000. And the reason it was £7,000 was because that was my entire worldly wealth when I set off aged 24.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem anything like enough money to make it around the world. So I then had a choice. You can either just go have a brilliant week-long bike trip to France, drinking champagne every night, or you can sleep in ditches and eat banana sandwiches and make it last for 4 years. So that sort of frugal approach to adventure is something that I'd very much built into a habit.
And who doesn't love a banana sandwich? Quite frankly, I know, I'm with you. I think a banana sandwich is delicious.
You were talking about not necessarily needing loads of money to do your adventures. And in your book, Micro Adventures, you talk about short adventures, and you've got this concept of the 5 to 9 adventure, haven't you? Like, leave work, have an adventure, go back in the morning. Do you think we rely too much on spending money or saving up a big sum of money or sticking it on the credit card to do things like holidays and adventures?
Definitely. When I started Micro Adventures, this was the idea of trying to encourage people to have short local adventures. And the reason I started that was because people were always saying to me things like, oh, I'd love to go do an adventure, but I haven't got enough time. Or I'd love to go do an adventure, but I haven't got enough money. They're the two big ones in life. So I started thinking, okay, none of us have as much time as we'd like. None of us, except maybe Andy, have as much money as we'd like. So what can we do? And that's why I decided to flip the notion of the 9 to 5, this sort of burdensome, grinding constraint of our life, and flip it around and say, well, what about your 5 to 9? That's 16 hours of hypothetical daily freedom. In theory, I think it's a good mental exercise to say, when I leave work at 5, I've got 16 hours till the morning. How can I use that? The best thing of that is when you get to the office in the morning and people go, oh, did you do anything interesting last night? For once, you don't have to lie and make something up. And you can say, yeah, last night I had a micro-adventure. I slept on a hill. Now, a little disclaimer, if it's raining, that's a rubbish idea. But on a warm summer's evening, it's glorious. And the wilderness is nearer than we think. And it's simpler than you might imagine to have an adventure. And on top of that, the benefits, the memories of that linger far longer than the tiny bit of cash you've spent.
So starting at the beginning, could I just sleep in my garden to begin with? Because to me, that would be an adventure, to sleep in my own garden. That'd be amazing. Yeah.
So when doing micro-adventures, it's been very much for me about listening to what's stopping people and then finding a smaller solution just to help people get started, get their foot in the door. And there are many reasons why the idea of heading out of town and sleeping on a hill is a hindrance. So one of the chapters of my book involves sleeping in my garden for the night. And I felt a bit of a fool, like a middle-aged guy walking out my house with my duvet and lying down on the lawn. But once I was there, I was like, this is more, it's like 80% the same as being on top of a mountain. You can see the stars, you feel the wind, you got the birds singing, you wake up at sunrise. Yeah, absolutely. You get a sense of the wilderness and the outdoors, and you've done it. And then importantly, because you've done that once, hopefully you think, I really love that. Therefore, you've got more impetus to go do something a bit bigger next time.
Do you end up saving, or are you adventurous with your money?
It kind of depends on the trip. So generally, my preference has been towards just trips whereby I can just save up my own cash and go do them. So walking across the empty quarter desert cost about $2,000, including flights. Walking across India cost me £500, including the flights. So these are pretty cheap things. But then rowing an ocean, that's a $40,000 kind of trip. Going to expeditions in the Arctic, they're big money. And that's when you have to start the world of corporate sponsorship rather than spending your own cash. And there's pros and cons of that. I mean, it's great, of course, to get someone else to pay you money to go on a camping holiday. But the downside of it is that you're putting your hopes and dreams very much in other people's mercy, whether they'll sponsor a trip or not. And my preference really has just been to save up my own money and to make things happen myself.
Simon, when you are saving money and you're putting it all into a bank account, is that the safest place to save money?
A bank account is the safest place to put it, and then you're not taking risk with the money. So you might think, oh, if I invest this money, I might get a return on it, or maybe I could grow my money. But then you're then running the risk of your investment going down in value. So you put it in a savings account, but then you want to know your savings account is safe, isn't it? Because I'm presuming when you do your adventures, you do actually plan these and think about protecting yourself. It's not completely gung-ho. So the FSCS sponsors this podcast. That's what protects your money in the savings account, up to £85,000 in each individually licensed bank. And you know that if that bank goes bust, you haven't lost the savings that you've built up to go walk across a desert.
What happens if you have a joint bank account?
If you've got a joint bank account, so one in two names, you know, yours and a partner's, whatever, that is doubled up. So from £85,000 up to £170,000.
Did you know that, Alistair?
I did not know that until the beginning of this podcast.
Have you ever had £85,000 in the bank, if that's not rude in asking?
No.
Okay, because it's a lot of money.
It
yeah,
is.
That's what I like, that sort of attitude. Not yet. Yes. Absolutely, yeah. Not yet. I'm just going to go back very quickly about these adventures. I go out for a walk, let's say, and I always turn right when I go to the end of my road. Occasionally I go, do you know, I'm going to go left. Does it start that small? Because to me, that is an adventure. I never go left. I never go that way down the river. I always go that way. So for me, you know, do you still have that in your everyday life, that sense of, actually, I'll just do it differently today and see what happens?
Yeah, one of the greatest things I've got from big adventures all around the world is a habit of curiosity. So coming out of tube stations at random exits and following your nose and going down random little back streets. This year, I'm climbing a tree once a month for 20 minutes, just to remind me to pay attention to how nature changes every month. So I think adventure very much begins by turning left out of your front door. And also, here's a thing for you next time you come out of your front door, is to look down your street and just think, if I keep going down there, left, right, for long enough, then you will end up in Africa. That was an amazing realization for me of beginning from my front door and making it off to China and Bolivia and stuff from my front door. And that has really opened up in my head this idea that the world and adventure begins at my front door, but that it's my choice to make it happen.
So with your trips, the ones that you have had to fund, like the rowing across the Atlantic, have you found that difficult financially planning? Because obviously you have to plan the event, but what about the financial aspects of them?
I hate it. Absolutely hate it. So my trips, I have to get a balance between being reckless and spontaneous and crazy enough for it to be an adventure versus some sort of pragmatism that I don't want to die and I want to make sure this succeeds. And therefore, I have spreadsheets galore of equipment and backup, and I know how to do this, and I know how to get rescued if this happens, and satellite phones, all sorts of complicated stuff to make sure things don't go disastrously wrong. But get the money spreadsheet out and my heart just sinks and my head explodes. And the fact that I got an A in GCSE maths, I'm a very clever man, a money spreadsheet just explodes my head. So I have to do it, but I hate it.
So what does your wife think of this approach?
My wife thinks most of my approaches are idiotic.
And so have you done anything about this sort of managing money scenario? Have you decided to just go, actually, do you know what? I don't like this. I'm going to get an expert to do it for me instead.
So my wife is an accountant. So we come at so many things in life from very, very different angles. It's interesting that it works well, but we are so ridiculously different. She obviously has got a sensible job, at which she has been in the same company for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
At the same company. Yeah, I won't comment
it
on my thought
so
of that.
It must seem so alien to you, that a desk job.
Well, if you love your desk job, then that is wonderful. And yes, she does love it. She really likes it. And she gets a thrill out of going to work and doing spreadsheets. And you get paid quite well to do it. And it's nice and secure. And crucially, she really enjoys it.
Perfect.
If she didn't enjoy it, then I'd be tearing my hair out at her. But she's, in many ways, much luckier than me, because she's found something that she enjoys consistently for 20 years rather than constantly chasing the moon like me. Hoping that just one more expedition and then I'll be happy and all my problems will be solved.
Is she funny? Because accountants are never funny.
My wife is really funny.
Okay, great. Yeah. I like that.
She's cool and she's an accountant.
A cool accountant?
Yeah. She's just like Simon. He's cool and he works for...
This Is Money.
Yeah.
.com.
.co.uk.
Sorry.
It's all right. If you put in .com, you'll get rerouted there.
Fine.
It's fine.
Oh, my word. So does she help?
Well... Yes, is the official family answer. So for you, when I started trying to make a living out of adventures, it was a fairly haphazard way. So I got back from cycling around the world. I had £300 left in the world. So I started having to get some cash. So I started doing talks at primary schools, essentially. And they'd pay me some cash into my bank account, which is the one I'd had since I was 8, from which I got because you got some cool free stuff from the bank.
By the way, this is classic bank account behaviour for Britons. Is there's this huge effort to try to get people to switch to bank accounts that would be better for them. Most people are basically with the bank they were with either as a kid because they got some piggy banks, or as a student because they got some free money.
Yeah.
Well, free money, I mean an overdraft that they had to pay back over the next 5 years, but
Yeah, so when I started the business side of adventure, it was doing a few talks and they'd pay me at first 50 quid, 100 quid, 150 quid, gradually creeping up. And all that just went in my bank account from an 8-year-old, jumbled up with me buying, I don't know, sausages and whatever else in my life. And then at the end of the year comes the agony of you have to pay tax, which in the first couple of years I'd totally forgotten about. So I'd spent basically all of my money. It took me quite a long time to remember that you have to actually save. When you get given £100, it's not all yours to spend on sausages. So my wife was very good in the early years of helping me navigate that minefield of how do you start to run a business out of doing something a bit silly like adventure.
And so in some ways, as an adventurer slash free spirit in that respect, your wife has helped you become slightly more financially responsible. Or is she always on your back still?
Well, so my hesitancy in the answers about her being helpful are unkind, because she was massively helpful for years. But if she hadn't been around, what I hope I would have done and what I now tell everyone to do is the first time you get paid £200, go find some random accountant down the road and say, please sort my life out. Because I really wish I'd done that as my very first act. That would have saved me so much boring complications. So having a wife to do that was, of course, helpful. However, she'd spent all day accounting with competent, interesting people. Then she comes home and she asked me, being just a moron about this stuff, she understandably wasn't that keen to untangle my life as well.
You'd lulled yourself into a false sense of security by having an accountant wife.
Yes, pretty much. That's a good summary, actually. And for quite a few years, the way it would happen is whenever you get to that crazy tax return day, is it end of January or something? There'd be this chaos which she would have to untangle. And I remember going to some place in London, like some office where you hand in your tax return if you're late.
Sounds about right. No, yeah. I've not been there personally.
Anyway, so I was in this queue of idiots all handing in this thing, and the guy behind me, I remember him, I overheard him saying, oh, I filled it in really badly, but I was told that if you just hand something in, you get some sort of extension. So that's the kind of world of incompetence that I was operating in that time, because I just didn't know any of this. I'd never been taught any of this at school or university. I had no idea and no interest either.
As they say nowadays, tax, doesn't have to be taxing.
Yes.
Simon, when you get that first cheque for £200, safest place, put it in the bank?
Put it in the bank. But if you are going to have to pay tax on it, mm-hmm. which i.e. you're earning it and you're not being taxed through work, through employment, take some money out of that and put it into a separate bank account.
Yeah.
So open up a separate savings account. A separate current account would do it, but if you open a savings account, you'll get at least a little bit of interest. Interest rates aren't great, but you'll get a little bit. Put it in there so it's not with the rest of your money, because that's where people end up easily spending the money and going, well, I kind of need to spend this money, and that's there, and I'll make it up next month. That next month never happens. And there's another trick, actually, that you can use. It's a mortgage trick. You can get a thing called an offset mortgage, where you balance the money in your bank account or your savings account against your mortgage, and you don't pay interest on that bit of your mortgage. So you only pay money on the balance. And that's quite good for self-employed people, because it means that you can put the money into an account, and instead of worrying about earning a savings rate, you're just not paying that money on the mortgage, and it's quite tax efficient, and you've got it there sorted away nicely. Because you end up, as a self-employed person, I know my wife is as well, you end up building up half a year, a whole year's worth of tax, and you're looking at that money going, I could do something better with this money than it just sitting there.
Yeah, but remember, when it's in the bank, up to £85,000, protect it. Have you got a pension?
I do now have a pension, yeah. I did a talk a while ago and to a pensions company, and they said, I haven't got one, and they basically said, you're a total idiot. It's not nearly as hard as you think. And so some man
came round.
Yeah, hopefully he was authorised and things. But yeah, some man came around, took all my details, and hopefully that means when I'm 75 and sitting by the fire, it'll all be under control. But yeah, I wish I'd got on with that 10 years earlier.
You've written so much about your adventures. 11 books to date.
13
books to date.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. Again, I don't even know when you find the time to write them. But which of them is the closest to your heart, would you say?
So I think the two. One would be my book about encouraging people to go sleep on a hill, micro-adventures. And the other would be my Spain book, which is trying to adjust to how can I be an adventurer and also a normal person with a normal life.
Is it easy to get a book written?
Getting a book written, I found actually harder than cycling around the world. Just sitting down in a room with a blank piece of paper for a year, I found agonising. But once you've done it, then you're kind of thrilled and you think, great, now all I do is I put it in the shops and I'll be rich and famous. But like a lot of beginning authors, no one had heard of me, no one cared, no one wanted to publish it. So I had about a year of full-on rejections. It was really quite depressing. And it was really hard. And eventually I found this little publishing company who said, yeah, we like it, we'll publish it. I'm like, woohoo, where do I sign? So I just didn't care at all. All I wanted was a finished book in the world. And even now, after all the books I don't really care about the money. It's just the pride of doing it. So this first book, I just signed the contract, whatever it is. I didn't even read it. Just sign it here, boom. And of course, time passes and I learned that actually it was a ridiculously duff contract. So I got completely stung, as did a lot of first-time people, and yeah, lessons learned.
So your tip to anybody who's trying to get a book published would be?
Well, first of all, sit down for a year and actually write the book before you start worrying about royalty checks, because most people get that the wrong way around. And then my tip would be, in the same way that I wish I'd spent my first £200 on an accountant, I'd probably spend my next £200 on someone who could actually read a contract without falling asleep and tell me if it was worth it. I definitely should have done that.
Have you ever self-published a book?
Yeah, I've self-published. My very first book, the one I've just told you about, I self-published that because no one wanted it. And then on the back of being self-published, that publisher came along. My 13th book, I've just chosen to go back to self-publishing just to give me the complete freedom and flexibility that self-publishing has.
And would you, if you were doing it all again, would you actually just go down the self-publishing route full stop? Because obviously that's changed quite a bit nowadays, hasn't it? And quite a lot of people do that, and it does give you the control you were talking about.
The technology of self-publishing is brilliant these days. There's massive advantages for it. Financially, if you self-publish a book on Amazon, you get 70% of the cover price, so £7 for a £10 book, compared to now I've got a proper book deal with proper contracts, I still get 10%. So it's a massive difference between being self-published and doing it with a publisher. I wouldn't, however, do it straight away, because if you self-publish, the thing that you need to have is an audience who will buy that book. So once you have an audience, then I think self-publishing is becoming the way to go. If someone buys one book on Amazon, Amazon prints one book and it gets sent out. It's print-on-demand technology. So one book is bought, one book is printed. The days of needing to order 5,000 of them to fill up your kitchen forever are gone.
Oh, okay.
It's print-on-demand. So the technology's changed. So you could upload a PDF today.
Yes.
And your granny could buy one copy of your book and she'll get it next week. And you'll get 70% of the cover price.
Love that.
Much better for the environment as well, rather than printing all these. I mean, obviously, with your books, you print copies and then they just have to keep printing more and more and more and more. But if I wrote one, it'd probably print 5,000 and they'd go in a shed somewhere and I'd be one day hoping that someone would come and take them away.
Yeah.
I thought it was very optimistic at 5,000, Simon. Now, you lost your camera once. Is that true?
Yes. So I work in a shed in my garden, which is great. Great place for writing books. And obviously a shed's not very secure, so I don't keep valuable stuff in there. But I often make films of myself in my shed, like for YouTube, of talking about books and stuff.
Right.
And one night I just had to pop back to the house for my tea or something. And I thought, I'll come back and film later. I was away for about an hour, doors ripped off, $5,000 worth of cameras, gone.
What, from your shed?
Yeah.
Your shed was robbed.
One of the reasons I came back was I was going to do a Skype call. I do quite a lot of Skype phone calls with schools to talk about adventures. And I was doing a talk with this school in North America that was scheduled. So I got back and my shed door has been ripped off and it's cold and winter and all my stuff's been nicked. But I have to immediately do this Skype call to this bunch of kids in North America. So I set up my computer in a ripped open shed and had a little chat with them.
Yep.
And then phoned the police.
Oh, you did the Skype call first?
Yeah, I did the Skype call with them. Always a professional.
And if it's revenue generating, always do it first.
Always do the Skype calls for free. I don't get paid for those.
Oh, why not?
I'm terrible at money things. If kids ask me to do stuff, I always do it for free.
Okay.
Is that not how Ed the Duck worked? out of the goodness of your heart.
But I would sit in the broom cupboard with him. Yeah. Do you know what? I worked for the BBC. I don't think I ever got any money. But what money I did get, 50% in my current account, 50% in my tax account.
Very sensible.
Smart man. This is a really boring question to ask.
Can I ask an even more boring one first?
Yeah, go on.
Because you'll know about insurance.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has a horror insurance story to tell just like that, where you've been paying your premiums and something happens and you don't get the money. In your professional opinion, do I weigh up, actually, my iPhone costs this, a year's of insurance is going to cost that, actually it would be cheaper just to buy a new one rather than insure it?
Maybe, yes. I think the thing with insurance for things like iPhones, for example, is if you balance the cost of that monthly insurance against the cost of just replacing it, and then the likelihood of you losing it or breaking it, and you personally will know how likely you are to lose or break your iPhone. Some people never lose or break their phones. Other people have permanently got a smashed screen or go through about 4 phones a year. So if you weigh that up, then you can kind of work it out yourself. And then when you look at the insurance, you need to look at all the little bits of small print, all the exclusions, and go, is this insurance worth paying? And also, with insurance, it's really important not to just go for the cheapest stuff, because often the cheapest stuff isn't that good, and it's worth paying extra for the better stuff. So the boring question I was going to ask you, for a man who does like really exciting expeditions and adventures, is, do you have travel insurance?
Yes.
And does that cost you loads of money, or are you just persona non grata in the travel insurance industry? Your name comes up and a big red flashing light goes off.
I always have health travel insurance, so repatriation insurance always, and I have various policies. I have a sort of normal one for normal trips to wherever, and then if you're going to, say, America, you have to pay more often. You have to pay more if you're going to do things like bicycles or scuba diving and stuff. And that is something where I do actually pay attention to things. And then if you go on expeditions like up to the Arctic, then you have to go for specialist insurance providers that cost quite a bit more cash. I generally don't bother with insuring my kit. I just see that as a you win some, you lose some approach to life.
Okay. Alistair, you've journeyed 46,000 miles, you've been through 60 countries, 5 continents. Can you remember the sunniest day?
The sunniest day, yeah. I've spent days and weeks with full sunshine. If you're up on the frozen Arctic Ocean, so the North Pole is the sea, but it's frozen over, and if you're camped up there on the ice, then in the summertime, it's 24 hours of daylight. So the sun never sets. It just goes round and round the sky. It's a bit of a nightmare to go to sleep, but it's glorious, incredibly beautiful. And you know that you're on about a metre and a half of ice, and under that is the cold, dark, freezing Arctic Ocean. But where you are, it's just this white emptiness, and the sun going round and round and complete silence and not a financial worry in sight.
Really, finally, what's the next big adventure? What do you need to do to die happy?
To die happy, I need to encourage a lot more people to climb a tree once a month, to just turn off their phones or look away from their phones and go look at the woods for a little bit and get out of town and go sleep on a hill with their kids.
You're an amazing man. I love it. And when I meet you in a year's time, I want to add at least three more things to the list of your achievements. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Simon.
Oh, thank you, Andy.
You're welcome.
That's okay.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, I know you're here.
It's nice to be here.
Okay, no, well, I know. Yeah. Well, if you've got your own time. Well, that's not... You obviously don't really like being here. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been in Prec getting a sandwich.
No, I was having an adventure on the tube. A micro-adventure.
Thanks for listening to Making the Money Work, brought to you by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme and This Is Money.